welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison, and coming up on the program...
The back part of the house is an attachment that was made in the 70s, and when I got to the house, it was a huge crack in the wall, and it looks like the back part of the house literally breaking off.
Housing is a very fraught issue at the moment, with the rental bond often one of the biggest obstacles to obtaining a rental home. What are your rights? Also on the program...
This is about picking the winners in terms of new technologies and new sectors of industry that provide us with future competitive advantage. If we don't adopt them, we will be left behind in this incredible race to improve the living standards and economic possibilities for the next generation.
Our manufacturing industries are changing, but how exactly is the digital age stimulating technological change? What is Industry 4.0? All this and more coming up on The Money. First, a slowdown in our economy and around the world has many Aussies questioning their own financial health. And a new study suggests almost a third of us are expecting the government for help in case of the worst. Compare the Market, along with Deloitte Access Economics, recently released its annual Financial Consciousness Index. Broadly, the news is not good, with 7.5 million Aussies struggling to pay bills on time and up to 13.4 million Australians saying they do not have enough saved up in case of sudden unemployment. I spoke with banking expert Rod Attrill of Compare the Market and started by asking if he was concerned by the trends in the data.
Yeah, I think the stats certainly do. I think people not having the ability to put some money away for anything that may happen to an unexpected bill or a higher than expected bill, I think is starting to impact their mortgage repayments. The mortgage repayment is usually the biggest repayment that someone will make in a month on a consistent basis over a year. So, as that wealth that's falling, there is also increases in other areas, energy and insurances and those type of things, as well as a low wage growth. So whilst those rates are coming down, it isn't sort of all balancing itself out as yet. The rate cut yesterday was a good step in the right direction, but we've also got to remember that's just the RBA rates cutting. So the individual, the borrower's bank, has to also pass on those rate cuts. And as we've seen in the past, not everybody passes on that full rate cut.
So, Rod, you surveyed 3,000 customers around the country and with the intention of giving Australians what you would call a reality check and an opportunity to motivate consumers to consider strategies to improve their financial positions. Can you tell us how this came about?
We commissioned the Financial Consciousness Index with Deloitte Access Economics last year. We've committed to doing an annual survey of customers across the country, and we take a sample from every state and a whole range of different people, and then that rolls up into a various score for each of the states and a national score, and it sort of gives us an idea of people's ability to not only know that they are in a situation where they may want to do something about their finances, but also do they think they've got the ability to do that. So they might be in a home loan that has a high interest rate and they know that they should be in something different, but do they have the ability or do they have the knowledge to actually know what to do? So it sort of measures it on two fronts. There's a lot of surveys around that might measure people's ability to pay something or people's ability to change something, but we try to do both of those to roll it up into a score that we can track each year.
So, Rod, some of the statistics in the report make for fairly grim reading. 2.8 million of us admit we struggle to pay most of our bills on time. 5.1 million people are not saving at all, or worse, are spending more than they earn. And 7.3 million Aussies say that their backup plan is to receive government benefits if the worst should happen. And this number is also up by 900,000 people since 2018. Do you think that Australians have a financial literacy problem, Rod?
I think there's some education requirements there, but there's also a real a real challenge for people just to be wanting to do it. It can be quite daunting. It's very overwhelming trying to look at a mortgage or your insurances or your energy and those type of things. So one of the things that we sort of talk about a lot is just do it with the triggers. So if you get your, every time there's an interest rate rise, decrease, the bank will tell you that there's been a decrease. They'll tell you what your new repayment is. Use that as a trigger just to make sure and compare to see that the rate you're on is competitive in the market. If your financial institution hasn't dropped the rates down the last couple of decreases from the RBA, it might be time just to see what else is around and see if there's something better. That'll actually save you a few dollars on your repayment. Same goes for insurances and energy. When you get that bill, whatever it may be, or that payment you need to make, you've got all the information you need on that piece of paper that you get. So just jump online and have a look to see if you're getting a good deal, because that'll actually help you save on that. I don't think there's the ability for people out there to make a change. I think it just is very daunting because it is such a big change to make. And you've got to put a bit of effort into it. And, you know, we're all really time poor these days, so it does take a bit of time to get it sorted.
So according to the index, Rod, 60% blame an increased cost of living, while 31% blame little or low wage growth in the last year. So while Australia is taking steps to improve our economy, should we be more wary of global economic forces now than we were in 2018?
Oh, I think it has. I mean, towards the back end of the year, there was obviously some global events. They're still going on now. We had a returning government in the election, so that sort of helped the local economy a little bit, that the government was returned. But there's been some really, really big events across the world that started to impact it. And you can start to see that the Australian dollar getting impacted as well with that. Brexit's probably the biggest one, the American issues that they're having with some of the other countries around the world. So that's starting to impact. It's starting to impact the dollar. So whilst our economic conditions are okay, they're only just okay. They're not great, which is also why we've started to see some of those interest rate decreases by the RBA.
One positive statistic that seemed to come out of the index was that an extra 128,000 people are saving at least 10% of their income. Is this a reasonable goal for someone to aim for when starting to consider a savings plan?
Look, I think 10% is a good number for us all to start at. It may not happen all the time, but it's a good number to aim at, because you can start to put a little bit of funds aside for anything that may come up that you don't expect. There's a lot of good budget tools out there. It's harder and harder with the budgeting tools, because we are we're getting to be a sort of a tap and go society with some of the payments that we make. So if people aren't keen to use a budget tool, just at the end of a fortnight, just go into your internet banking and just see where you've spent your money and how much is left over, because you'll be able to go back for a fortnight's transactions and, you know, sometimes you'll be a bit surprised of what you've spent your money on, because, you know, we all tap and go with various purchases, and if you add that up over a fortnight, you might find that there'd be some savings there. But that 10% is probably where we think people should start, and hopefully as the mortgage rates come down, they might be able to put a little bit more away.
And lastly, Rod, what is the one bit of advice you'd like to give our listeners that would make a difference to their financial situation?
I think research and education, which are very tightly combined in our eyes. I think the researching whenever something comes up. So when that bill comes up, which is what I was chatting about before, just research. Just make sure that you're getting a good deal. I mean, you might actually be getting a great deal, but you'll just know, and you'll be able to have educated yourself to say, okay, well, I know my mortgage is in a good space, or I know my energy bill is in a good space. And then as you start to go through those, you'll start to be a little bit more healthier in that finance side of things, but you haven't had to hit it all at once. So just take it slowly, just check what's in there, and just make sure that you're getting the right deal. That, you know, when it comes in and when you see different rates, you've got a bit more of an idea in your head about what you should be paying. So that's sort of one of the things that we'd advocate quite heavily.
That was Rod Attrill, banking expert with Compare the Market. I'm Daniel Ellison, and you're listening to On the Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
A lot of people are finding that it is becoming increasingly complex to rent a flat or apartment, and not just because of the price. There is the bond to consider, and frequently the document you must sign means that you are up for a lot of expensive cleaning and sometimes even painting as well. So how do you navigate the tenant bond minefield? Veronica Alashina has the story.
Please explain.
How far up the list of issues are issues related to bonds?
They're very close to the top. It's probably one of the biggest issues we come across because it can cover a whole range of things. So people have disputes about the bond at the time that they're moving in and whether the bond is lodged and if they're being asked for too much money. And at the end, from repairs issues and you know, damage that's happened during the tenancy, as well as rent arrears.
For those just entering the rental market, what is a bond and why do we pay it?
A bond is essentially an amount of money that the landlord requires the tenant to pay as a form of security at the beginning of a tenancy. It is not a legal requirement for the landlord to ask for a bond. So some landlords, very few, don't ask for bonds. But if they do ask for a bond, they're entitled to ask for up to 4 weeks' rent. It's there to protect you against the potential costs at the end of the tenancy. Any breach of your tenancy agreement, whether it's, you know, causing some damage either intentionally or negligently, or leaving owing some amount of money from the rent or a utility bill, something like that, to ensure that you don't have to come up with, you know, what can be a significant amount of money.
So what can be taken out of your bond and what can't? What are tenants liable for?
When you move in and it's in a particular condition, over the time that you live there, carpets will naturally get a bit frayed because you're walking on them, or you know, the curtains will lose a bit of colour because the sun's shining on them all the time. That's called fair wear and tear, so it's where sort of natural use of the property causes some damage. And tenants aren't liable for fair wear and tear, but what you are liable for is damage that was caused either intentionally, which, hopefully you never put your fist through a wall or something, but it can happen, or negligently, which is what most damage actually happens, which is really another way of saying that you did something or didn't do something that an ordinary person could see would cause some damage. So what often comes up is people might take a hot pot off the stove and then put it down again on the bench top without putting any protection underneath it. Things like spilling wine on the floor is usually seen as negligence because you probably should have foreseen that putting it on the floor wasn't a good idea. You should have put it on the table.
Bonds must be lodged with the rental bond board and held in trust until the end of the lease period. But what happens then? Pandora had to negotiate the return of her bond after moving from Sydney to Perth for 1 year to pursue tertiary studies. She didn't get to inspect the property before moving in, and within a few days began to suspect something was not right.
Yeah, when I moved into the house, one of the ladies was already living there and me and two other guys moved into the house. She'd been living there for around 2 years already, and she was telling me all the maintenance problems and everything that's already gone wrong. The carpet looked like no maintenance had been done over the years. The back part of the house used an attachment that was made in the 70s, and when I got to the house, it was a huge crack in the wall, and it looked like the back part of the house was literally breaking off. The garden was terrible. There was pretty much no grass. Every time we'd have a shower, the water would actually build up in the bath. The neglect of maintenance was quite obvious when I got there. It was beyond fair wear and tear.
How did you go about signing the rental contract? Did they talk you through the process at all?
They kind of just gave it to us and expected us to sign it straight away without actually reading through it, and were really quite pressuring in a way for us to just sign it without reading anything.
They didn't make you aware that you needed to fill in a condition report before moving in?
No, not at all. They didn't tell us any of that. And I think the attitude that a lot of real estate agents seem to have is that when there's tenants who are in their late teens or in their 20s, they kind of just assume that they can get away with a lot of stuff because we're too young to kind of realise what our rights are. So that kind of got us in a bit of trouble at the end of our lease.
Okay, so the condition report is a document that is required under the Residential Tenancy Act, and it's required by the contract. So first, when you move in, the landlord has to give you a completed copy of the condition report. So they go through the house before you move in, saying what the condition is. And usually the condition report talks about things being clean, working, and damaged or damaged, and either yes or no for you know, all walls and windows and flooring and ceilings and so on. Then you have 7 days to fill out a second copy, which is your version of the condition of the property. And it is fine, in fact, it's the point, if you disagree with what the landlord has said. Some people are a bit hesitant to put in a different answer to what the real estate agent or the landlord has entered, but that is the purpose of the document. We actually also these days recommend people take photos because, you know, when somebody says scuffed as a comment about a wall and somebody else says marked and somebody else says dirty, they might all be describing the same thing. And it can be unclear what they actually mean, whereas a photo is much more objective and you can see that condition report then becomes the most important piece of evidence when considering whether you should get the full bond back at the end.
Our condition report of the house that was given to us was from 2009. So that also helped my case as well, because they neglected to do a condition report for almost 10 years.
When negotiating the release of the bond, Mr. Patterson Ross says agents are not your friend.
They are there to perform a job for the landlord. They're a contractor who's been hired to protect the landlord's interests. And so when you're in a negotiation with them about damage to the property, they are there to ensure that as much as possible they get your bond. That is actually their legal obligation, is to act in the interests of the landlord.
That was Leo Patterson Ross of the Tenants Union of New South Wales, ending that report by Veronica Alashina. You're listening to On the Money Around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison. The Australian manufacturing industry is changing rapidly in the contemporary age of digital innovation. Companies across industries are integrating ever more robotics and AI into their production chains, with efficiency through automation as the goal. But what is the role of us people in the time of iRobot? Guest producer Michael Lester from Radio Northern Beaches spoke with Professor Roy Green, Vice Chancellor, Innovation and Enterprise at UTS, to find out.
How will this advanced robotics manufacturing hub actually involve and engage with the manufacturing sector in Australia, and particularly the small and medium enterprises?
Of course, manufacturing is very different now from what it used to be. No one right way. Everybody will experiment. If you look at Ducati in Italy, that's a very different operation. Again, very big emphasis on design and quality at the high end, and they have a production line with robots, but the robots are there to help the humans. Each vehicle is sort of lovingly made by humans, but with the robots standing next to them or around them, doing all the fiddly bits that the humans are that now relieved from doing.
Yeah, well, of course, what we're discussing here, digital design and manufacturing, that's been around for quite a few decades, but it does seem that this new wave that we're talking about is actually really significantly qualitatively transformative and different to that. I wonder what the future is for Australia in that. I mean, we apparently at the moment have quite a number of very thriving software companies in Australia, and one in particular is Altium, which is worth some $5 billion already. And it designs software electronic circuitry design tools, which can be used by other people, and also is moving towards building big standardized platforms for this sort of design work to be done by manufacturing on a global scale. How does a company like CEO Altium fit in to what's happening?
Well, that's an area where we can get great competitive advantage. These are not necessarily companies which are household names, because they're part of the supply chain.
Yes.
Companies that are, you know, more based on a consumer product like Rode microphones, they're more visible and no less interested in Industry 4.0 techniques. Rode Microphones has built itself up to a manufacturing company that produces 60,000 microphones a month for the world market, constantly renewing its products and doing so in the context of a very creative social media presence. The CEO there, now styled as the Steve Jobs of Australian manufacturing. There are others, of course, out there which are well known, Atlassian in accounting software, WiseTech in logistics, another company that grew out of a university project, indeed at UTS, and now is worth several billion. These are companies that are feeding into the manufacturing supply chain, as well as others, using these advanced techniques, including an element of machine or artificial intelligence, whereby they don't just do the jobs that they're programmed to do. They invent them. They invent new jobs for themselves by improving the processes as they go.
It does seem that a company like Altium and the whole software-based idea for design is at the heart of what's going on in the transformation of manufacturing.
Absolutely. And we see the application of such technologies not just in manufacturing, in agribusiness now, with the use of sensors, drones, geospatial technologies. These are extraordinary developments, improving whole sectors of our economy. Adaptation of those technologies and their application to these sectors is crucial to our future living standards, which is why it's important for our companies not to lag in the take-up of these technologies. And that brings us to policy and institutional support. This is about picking the winners in terms of new technologies and new sectors of industry that provide us with future competitive advantage. If we don't adopt them, we will be left behind in this incredible race to improve the living standards and economic possibilities for the next generation.
Some of the skills that are required here are very much not just tech skills to make all this transformation happen with digital design. For example, I understand there's a growing demand for interface creators, for the booming demand in voice user interfaces. And they're the sort of skills that they talking about language skills, psycholinguistics, sales and marketing, rather than from computer and engineering. So there's a strong human and humanities dimension in all this transformation of manufacturing, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And sometimes we get obsessed with our science and engineering skills and whether we have a shortage of them. Certainly that's an important element here, but also cannot ignore the broader skills which are transferable and which cross the boundary, that include creativity and critical thinking and analytical problem-solving skills that prepare you for a world of work where you can't actually predict what your job will look like in a few years' time. So you need some specialisation, but you don't want too much of it because those specialisations will be superseded by others. And therefore, the skills of adaptability are just as crucial to becoming employable.
This skill-based question must be a challenge and an opportunity for our universities and training institutions.
Absolutely. And, of course, all universities are trying very hard to anticipate what future trends and requirements will require them to adopt for new programs. One that, you don't mind me mentioning UTS again, is our new Bachelor of Creative Intelligence and Innovation. We introduced this maybe five or six years ago without necessarily doing much market research because there wasn't necessarily a market to look at. It was a hunch that this is where things were going to move in the future, something very multidisciplinary, almost transdisciplinary, which brought students from all over the university, from engineering, from science, from business, from the humanities, in a single program that would provide them with these boundary-crossing skills as well as the specialised knowledge that comes from their own degree course. We advertised initially 200 places, 3,000 applications, and growing fast ever since, with now one of the highest ATAR scores of any program in New South Wales. So quite clearly, that was an area that that young people and their teachers decided was important for the future.
Professor Roy Green, Vice Chancellor Innovation and Enterprise at UTS, ending that report by Michael Lester of Northern Beaches Radio. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison.
My name is François Carrière. I am at the UTS Business School, and you are listening to On the Money, summing up finance in one easy bite.
That's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Thanks very much to producer Michael Lester and executive producer Veronica Alashina. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast. New episodes are coming out every week. To follow us on Twitter, you can look for @onthemoney2ser, and you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram for updates. I'm Daniel Ellison. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.